3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your hands.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Monday Breakfast Show for Monday, the 16th of February, 2026. It's 1.5 minutes past 7 in the morning. Actually, kind of cold this morning. I think maybe I've started to actually get used to the heat over the past 6 weeks or so. That's been pretty bad, and I woke up this morning and I thought it was really cold and everything, but then I checked my phone and it was only like 16 degrees and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, which is, it's kind of jarring, I guess, especially since it's meant to be so hot today. I think it's meant to be in the 30s. And no rain, but for the rest of the week, I think it's meant to be pretty wet. So if you're traveling out and about during the week, take an umbrella with you, take a jacket. As hot as it's meant to be, it's also going to be quite wet. Anyway, I'm Rob, and for the next 90 minutes, we'll be bringing you a few things from across across the current affairs world. We're going to start the show off with the second half of an interview that we played last week from Tuesday Home Time, from the Tuesday Home Time show, which Jan Bartlett speaks with Kathy Kelly, who's a veteran US human rights activist, about the climate of fear and intimidation in the US, as well as the recent actions of ICE, and comparing that to the actions of authorities in Germany during the 1930s. And then following that, we're actually really excited to be bringing you a new regular segment here on the Monday Breakfast Show. It's called Wing Beats Per Minute, and today's episode is going to focus on insects' importance within ecosystems. So that's happening at around 7:30. And following that, we are going to hear an excerpt from yesterday's Concrete Gang show, where the folks on that show speak about the Jeffrey Watson SC's report, which was released on Wednesday at Queensland's Commission of Inquiry, which, as I'm sure listeners have seen or may not have seen, caused, you know, another round of mainstream media articles about the CFMEU and its alleged, you know, million things of wrongdoing. We'll be hearing that, and yeah, I think it's always important to get a worker perspective and a members of the CFMEU perspective on that. So that's happening at around 7:45. And then following that, we'll be doing an interview that I'm very excited for. We'll be speaking with Dr. Corinna Saxby, who will be telling us about research that they released last week, which revealed that adding gender-affirming surgery and care into the Medicare scheme would save millions in taxpayer dollars. Which when I first saw that article from, I believe I got it in a newsletter from this transgender journalist, and their newsletter is called Erin in the Morning from the States. I was, yeah, super excited to read it. And yeah, honestly, it makes a lot of sense, you know, especially that, like, not only does, and this is something that trans and gender diverse people have been saying for years, right? Not only does gender affirming surgery and care save lives, but in that regard, adding gender-affirming surgery and care into the Medicare scheme would also save a lot of money, you know, purely just out of the fact that trans and gender diverse people would not necessarily be accessing mental health services at the rates they do. Their employment rates could potentially go up. I was reading last night that trans and gender diverse people are four times more likely than our cisgender counterparts to be unemployed. So that interview is happening at 8 o'clock or just after 8 o'clock, depending on how the show goes. And so for now, I guess we will get into our headlines after a few announcements.
Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Trans Family are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. Trans Family is a 3CR supporter. We are family. Get up, 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 16th of February, 2026. Liberty Victoria has condemned the reported use of force by New South Wales police against protesters during demonstrations in Sydney linked to the visit of Israeli President Isaac Herzog, describing the images as deeply troubling and incompatible with democratic freedoms. Legal observers and attendees have alleged excessive force, including the use of capsicum spray, aggressive crowd control tactics, and the disruption of Muslim worshippers engaged in prayer. The civil liberties body says the events highlights the risks of expanding police powers to restrict protest. In particular, it has urged Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen to abandon proposed legislation that would mirror New South Wales laws, granting police broad authority to shut down or move protests following terrorism events. Liberty Victoria President Gemma Caffarella said the scenes coming out of Sydney should serve as a warning to governments across the country. They said, quote, "The images and reports from Sydney are chilling. Police running at protesters and violently disrupting people engaged in prayer. These scenes have no place in a democracy. Our thoughts are with all those who have been injured and otherwise affected," end quote. Caffarella said members of the community are entitled to express dissent, particularly in the light of ongoing proceedings before the International Court of Justice, where Israel faces allegations of genocide. Caffarella said, quote, attempting to restrict protest and handing police broad powers with reduced accountability does not keep anyone safe. The laws that led to this situation in New South Wales must not be replicated in Victoria. We call on police and politicians across Australia to respect the right of our community to express their views through protest and to ensure they can do so safely, end quote. Also in the news this week, Palliative Care Australia has thrown its support behind calls to expand the Commonwealth PRAC payment to include medical and allied health students following the release of new costings from the Parliamentary Budget Office commissioned by Independent MP Helen Haynes and Independent Senator David Pocock. The costings estimate the expansion would cost $290 million over 4 years. PCA says broadening the payment would help reduce financial hardship during mandatory placements and strengthen the future health workforce, including in palliative care services. PCA National Policy Director Josh Fear said unpaid placements are placing significant strain on students and risk undermining workforce supply. They said, quote, palliative care is delivered by multidisciplinary teams, and we need a strong pipeline of medical and allied health professionals to meet community needs, end quote. And they continued, quote, when students are required to complete unpaid placements, it can force real financial stress, and it can put completion of training at risk, end quote. The Commonwealth PRAC payment began on the 1st of July 2025 for nursing, midwifery, teaching and social work students. Dr. Haynes and Senator Pocock are calling for it to be expanded in line with recommendations from the university's Accord final report. Their announcement coincides with new survey data from the Health Students Alliance, showing 42% of students reported going hungry while on placement. Mr. Fear said expanding the payment would be a practical reform with long-term benefits. Quote, expanding the PRAC payment to medical and allied health students is a practical, achievable reform that supports equity and strengthens the workforce, particularly in rural and regional areas, end quote. PCA is urging the Australian government to act, arguing that placement should not become a barrier to qualification and that ensuring students can complete their training is essential to delivering timely care to patients and families who need it. And finally, in the news this week, Independent Victorian Senator Lydia Thorpe has renewed calls for the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion to expand its terms of reference to cover all forms of right-wing extremism and violence, including racism against First Peoples. Her comments follow statements in Senate estimates by Indigenous Australians Minister Malandiri McCarthy, who said she had discussed including racism and hatred directed at First Peoples within the Royal Commission scope and expressed concern about the rise in openly displayed racism. Senator Thorpe said the issue had taken on renewed urgency following the terrorist bomb attack at an Invasion Day rally in Boorloo last month, which left many in the community shaken. Senator Thorpe noted that it took time for authorities to formally characterize the incident as a terror attack, a declaration that came after pressure from First Peoples advocates and a Senate motion Thorpe herself introduced. While the National Indigenous Australians Agency has been invited to attend meetings connected to the Royal Commission, the terms of reference have not been fully expanded. It is essential to combat anti-Semitism, but is just as essential to combat all forms of right-wing extremism in this country. Without doing this, we are not targeting the root cause of the violence and hatred we see rising in this country, Senator Thorpe said. They continued, quote, First Peoples are sacred. The Boorloo terror attack left us all shaken and worried about what comes next. Yet there is never urgent political action to target racism in all its forms. It seems that the lives of First Peoples and black and brown people are somehow worth less, end quote. Senator Thorpe said inviting the NIAA to meetings was not enough and called on the government to formally broaden the inquiry. they said, quote, the government needs to officially expand the Royal Commission to look into all forms of right-wing extremism, because it is not just Jewish people in this country, it is also First Peoples, Muslims, and Black and Brown people. We need to stand with everyone and make sure all our communities are safe, otherwise there cannot and will not be social cohesion, end quote. She also criticized recent government and policing responses to protests linked to the visit of Israeli President Isaac Herzog and raised concerns about restrictions on protest rights. They said, quote, protest bans violate our human right to assemble. Banning certain phrases violates our human right to free speech. We cannot let our rights be taken from us. We will keep standing together and rising against an increasingly authoritarian regime. End quote. These have been the news headlines for Monday, the 16th of February. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. Stay tuned.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. Before we head into our first segment of the show, I'd just like to quickly remind listeners that the station's subscribe-a-thon is continuing and ongoing, and yeah, we would love your support to help keep the station alive. There are many, many reasons to subscribe to 3CR, particularly the voice that 3CR provides for unheard and underrepresented artists and organizations, as well as honestly just people that the mainstream media will not interview, you know, thinking of Palestinian people, Indigenous people, working class people, trans and queer people. All of these people regularly feature on 3CR, and for that 3CR should stay alive. So you can call 9419-8377 to subscribe, or visit 3cr.org.au/donate to subscribe. And there's a few different options there depending on whether your concession, your wage, your unwaged. And we even have an option for a band or an organization to subscribe. So yeah, call the number 9419-8377 or visit our website, or even come in during business hours on 21 Smith Street and yeah, have a look around and see the station for yourself, and hopefully you can subscribe. Anyway, now we're going to hear the second part of an interview from the Tuesday Hometime show, in which Jan Bartlett speaks with Kathy Kelly, who is a veteran US human rights activist, about the climate of fear and intimidation in her country, in particular with the recent actions of ICE, and draws comparisons to Germany in the 1930s.
Are parents actually being ripped away from their children and taken to, well, nobody knows where?
Yes, this is definitely happening. I mean, for example, one place that's still operative is called Alcatraz, and it's in the state of Florida, and it's deliberately being constructed in a swampy area so that the prison will be surrounded by alligators and pythons. Now, it's interesting that in Israel, Dan Grenier, one of the officials that Prime Minister Netanyahu is closely allied to, would like to build a similar place for detention in Israel. And it's also interesting that the construction company working to extend and build out this facility in Florida, the Gotham Construction Company, had also put in a bid for reconstructing Gaza, because these companies that know how to do demolition and reconstruction are looking at Gaza and thinking, wow, there could be big money. And in fact, the Gotham Company had already designed a scheme such that every truck that would enter into Gaza with a commercial load to deliver would be charged over $1,000 per truck for fees, and the humanitarian deliveries would each have to pay $300. And then whoever's overseeing all of that trucking would end up with over $1 billion. And, well, then it turned out the Guardian did a long interview with the person who's in charge of this Gotham Construction Company. And after that interview was over, he said, you know what, in January of 2026, he said, we're withdrawing our bid because of the risk of bad publicity and security. But there are plenty of other construction companies that know how to build up detention systems in the United States, and they're now looking at Gaza. But the United Nations is emphasizing that there are 60 million tons of rubble that will have to be removed. Just since the ceasefire was declared in Gaza, 2,500 structures have been destroyed. And so disease is spreading. People don't have immunities. The doctors can't get to people. They don't have labs and equipment. Meanwhile, the 60 million tons of rubble would require 3,000 container ships to be removed. And it can take years. And then there's unexploded ordnance underneath the wreckage. And disease spreads because of tainted water and sewage that is spreading through the streets that look like big dirt canyons. It's a nightmare. And this is what Israel has caused in a collective punishment inflicted on civilians. It's a genocide that is ongoing. And the response coming from the United States has been one of trying to figure out how billionaires can become even richer, as they suggest problem solving.
Isn't a different type of collective punishment also happening in the United States for the Latino population?
Well, I think that would be fair to say, yes, that the Latino population in the United States is being told, if you look like you are not a white person, that's enough reason for us to break into your home without a warrant, or to pull you off to the side in your car. And if you show any kind of resistance, you could be risking your life. But the thing about the randomness now, with the death of Alex Preti, who was a white ICU nurse, is that I think there's a deliberate effort to spread a blanket of fear so that people don't have a sense of, oh, well, if you do this and don't do that, then you'll be safe. I think in Minneapolis, people are thinking, you know, all bets are off. You're not safe no matter who you are, no matter where you are. And I think that that's the kind of Gestapo tactic that the United States is now endorsing and spreading in the way that they train these ICE agents, and particularly having sent so many militarized policing groups over to Israel for training.
Does anyone know where these ICE operatives are being trained? I know you say some of them are going to Israel, but they can't all go, and there's an awful lot of them, isn't there?
Well, that's certainly true, and there are recruitments going on all the time. Recruiters are offering high salaries and looking to places where people are gun owners. So, no, I don't want to imply that everybody is going over to Israel for training, but I think that the kinds of tactics that the Israeli Defense Forces and Offensive Forces have been using are being adapted increasingly amongst law enforcement people in the United States, and also the kinds of weapons that they rely on, certainly tear gassing, going in with heavily armed vehicles, masking the military people, and telling people that if they don't stay away, that they're basically the ones who are at fault because they didn't follow orders.
Doesn't a climate of fear actually paralyze society?
It'll be interesting to see how this climate of fear plays out in terms of boosting people's examination of what tactics they can use that might not be so frightening. And one of those tactics is a general strike. You know, if businesses shutter their windows and doors, if people who have stocks sell them off, if university students stay home, if businesses don't have clients to come into the stores, then it could be that a message would be sent that President Trump and his ilk would understand. So I've not heard so much discussion of the idea of a general strike as I have in the past few days. And people in Minneapolis did go on a general strike last Saturday.
I'm hearing stories about people talking about civil war.
You know, I realize that there are many people who endorse what President Trump has called for and voted for him. But my guess is that this is a time that's very, very ripe for winning people over to a side that would be non-cooperative with President Trump. It is certainly troubling that people are so heavily armed in the United States. But it would surprise me if things escalated to the point of a new civil war.
Do you have problems equating what's happening at the moment with fascist Germany, as you did earlier?
I think we are in our 1930s moment. You know, there were people who were very, very brave and said, "We will not be silent," and they risked their lives and they were killed. But as some have pointed out, in Germany, there was a point where the Germans kind of tried to hide their killing and their torture and their abuse. They shipped people off to concentration camps, and those places were isolated and somewhat hidden. Now, this doesn't mean that people living nearby couldn't smell the burning flesh as the crematoria were burning more and more people who had been gassed. And it doesn't mean that there weren't stories that got out. But the Trump administration doesn't try to hide what they're doing. I think they display it and flaunt it. And similarly, Netanyahu flaunts international law, boldly goes into the West Bank and into Gaza, and they just count on being able to get away with it, that nobody will hold them accountable, that they'll have indefinite impunity. This might not be the case. I think we're beginning to see some pushback even from allies. And this isn't to say that, you know, people like Mark Carney in Canada don't have their own abuses when it comes to being extractive and endangering the environment, or when it comes to promoting militarism. But we did see in Davos that there were several heads of state who let President Trump know that they were no longer going to be obeisant.
Looking at your own role and those of your friends in the activist movement, how are you coping with the situation and what can you do?
Well, I think it's important to remember those people in the White Rose movement in Berlin in Germany and other cities. They just said, we will not be silent, and they continued writing their leaflets, distributing those leaflets, being very, very brave. And so I think we have to keep on writing, keep on speaking, and not allow fear tactics to silence us. And I've been so impressed by the numbers of people that have turned out in very, very bitter cold weather for demonstrations. And also, one of the ways to stop a next war is to continue telling the truth about this war. We're embroiled in war against Venezuela, war against Somalia, provisions Israel to continue to attack Palestinians, threats of war against Iran, war against civilians in the United States. So I think it's a crucial time to keep speaking, keep writing, keep acting. I'm so glad to see that World Beyond War is developing a flotilla along with Code Pink to go to Venezuela. You know, these kinds of bold actions that are highly visible, I think, will be increasingly crucial. And there's also another flotilla planned for the springtime to Gaza.
And also the importance of social media at this time to break down the lies that they're being told, particularly with the death of the man a couple of days ago, when the authorities came out and just told lie after lie after lie, and the social media posts just say, that's not true.
Yeah, I think that's very important. You know, people immediately started to post, for instance, from Minneapolis, videos that made it very, very clear that President Trump and the Department of Homeland Security and Kristi Noem were not telling the truth. On social media, we are regularly reading posts by very well-respected international law scholars decrying the ways in which international law is being abused and flaunted. And I think we're seeing the work of eminent scholars. I think of Dr. Alfred McCoy. I think of Ralph Nader. I think of Masha Gessen. And you can continually read what their analysis is. And my hope is that young people are finding their way to those kinds of perspectives and sharing those perspectives with one another.
Thanks so much for today, Kathy. And we keep fighting in there, and it's the only way you're going to defeat the bastards.
Well, Jan, thank you. It's always important to know what your questions are. And the perspective of people from Australia has been so important for us. I mean, one of the most gratifying activities for me has been to connect with Australians in Melbourne and Sydney to help resettle young Afghans. You know, their lives have been made so miserable by United States war following up on the Soviet war and then the Taliban takeover. And the stalwart tenacity of people to say, we're not going to give up on trying to get people to a safer haven has been very impressive.
Thank you, Kathy.
And thank you, Jan. Wishing you well.
You too. And I've been speaking with activist and writer Kathy Kelly from Chicago.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That was Jan Bartlett from Tuesday Hometime speaking with Kathy Kelly, a veteran human rights activist, about the climate of fear and intimidation in the US, in particular with the recent actions of ICE, and comparing them to Germany in the 1930s. We played the first half of that interview on last week's show, which you can access at 3cr.org.au/Monday-breakfast or wherever you get your podcasts. And, of course, you can hear more from Jan Bartlett on 3cr.org.au/hometime-tuesday or tune in to 3CR on Tuesdays from 4 p.m. Very important interview to be doing, especially, you know, as, ICE continues to literally just kidnap people off the street without any sort of accountability. I was listening to Democracy Now! On the way here, and I had completely forgotten about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which was passed in July of last year, which gave ICE a lump sum of $75 billion, which because of that bill, that's the actual name of the bill, by the way. That's not me calling it beautiful. So $75 billion has been legally set aside and is available for the agency to use up until September 30th, 2029, meaning that no matter what happens with the US government's battles for funding in Congress, ICE will have a stable core of funding. $75 billion is just, it's so much money, and I can't even wrap my head around how much good that money could be used for, if it was actually used for things like housing and food and other things. Anyway, we're going to keep going with our next segment on the Monday Breakfast Show. This segment is called Wing Beats Per Minute. It'll be a new regular segment on the Monday Breakfast Show. And today's episode will be focusing on the importance of insects within ecosystems.
Insects and music, you can't refuse it. It's time to choose it before we lose it. 90 boom at 120 hash. When beats per minute happen so fast.
When beats per minute. When beats per minute.
Mate, we've made it. 3CR.
Awesome.
What a dream and a privilege to be here on Community Radio to talk about one of our very passions amongst a few, insects. My name is Michael. I describe myself as a conservationist that loves insects, does my best to try and understand their role in the system, and as a result have come across so many different cool insects due to their behaviours and their interactions with other fauna, and just seeing how cool they look with their mimicry, their colours and their patterning. And I want to spruik how important they are and get more and more people to understand how they are actually influenced by insects, perhaps subconsciously. They may not even have any idea.
I like this subconscious element here. My name's Jared, and I'm also very interested in insects, mainly because of the way that they are placed within the system. I think the main points of this show is looking at systems and how insects interact within the system. I've been working in the industry quite a long time. Some people would say too long, other people wouldn't. We're going to be rapping about insects in the system.
This is a new segment on 3CR that will roughly span sort of that 10 to 15 minute mark. And it focuses on how wonderful insects are and their role in systems, how important they are, and why we should start managing for them. We're not experts. We're people that love insects. We're conservationists. We're ecologists to a degree. And what we think is that insects are often the forgotten animal group when it comes to discussing the beauty of forests, grasslands, riparian areas, any natural area really. So I thought for our show we'd have five main objectives that we'd try and cover each episode.
Right.
Obviously we're going to go off topic a little bit from time to time.
Yeah, what have we got?
But here we go. I'm going to run you through them. So the first one is to explain and show how cool insects are with their wonderful colours and designs and their fascinating life cycles and behaviour. So we're going to talk about insect groups, some of their shapes and colours and so forth. The second objective is explain the linkages insects have with other fauna and what this means for ecosystem health and resilience.
This is key, isn't it?
Absolutely, mate.
Yeah, this is key. That's the general term. There's web of life.
Yeah.
But that's key.
Absolutely. Keys to the city, mate.
Yeah, that's keystone.
keystone. The third one being, explain how areas can be managed for insect diversity. Now, I think you can do some absolute key things. They're lower down in the trophic chain insects, but if you get habitat right for insects, it often means that things higher up the chain are going to benefit from that. Classic one is birds. Insectivore birds mostly will feed on insects, even though they say they're honey eaters.
True.
But they love it certain times of year when there's not a lot of honey out there. In terms of, when I say honey, I mean nectar from flowers. They're feeding on insects. So we'll go into a bit more detail about that.
If you're managing for insects, then you're definitely managing for habitat and ecology, because they're just critical to the whole system.
Yeah.
But every element is critical to the system. I mean, if you're also looking at soil. Like,
absolutely.
Soil holds the greatest biodiversity of the system.
Yep. Yeah.
We can't see it.
No.
We can't see it. We can't perceive it.
No. So I thought we'd get into beetles, mate, and they're one of the, well, probably the largest grouping within insects. And I'm going to start with jewel beetles, which is the eighth largest family of beetles, and they have these really cool hardened wings, which are shells on the top, that don't really assist them with flying, to my knowledge. But they have these miraculous colours on them and patterns. And so they're offering, for the most part, protection, because if something wants to come along, if you've got hardened shells, it's easier to protect other morphological features that are important for their lives. And at the moment, you know, if you go to certain flowering plants like sweet baseria and a few other flowering plants that flower earlier on in the year, like conzias, as we know.
What's the common denominator there? It's white flowers, isn't it?
It's the white flowers. Generally, white flowers are giving off a smell. And
definitely.
A lot of insects can pick up on that smell. A classic one is like using their antennae. So antennae often pick up on smell, and so that attracts. But the thing is, plants often appear white to us, but they might not be appearing white also to another
That's
insect.
An excellent comment, because, insects generally see in UV, as far as I understand.
Native bees, for instance, they can see in the ultraviolet colour.
It's ultraviolet.
Yellow.
Yeah, you're right.
And if you think of Prostrantha, like Christmas bush, if you don't go and have a really good look at that white flower, you might not see the purples and the yellows there. So they offer a runway for some bees, and I'd imagine other insects.
That's literally true. And once again, we can't perceive this sort of stuff. And that's what we're talking about. Like, why do we have to keep putting human-centric stuff on here? Because we cannot perceive UV. We cannot perceive the way that the insects and birds perceive the flowers.
Absolutely. And another group that we're seeing a little bit, not so much this year, it hasn't been an amazing insect year in terms of diversity, but I have seen some of these insects through my studies, and that's the Schaefer beetles. So we've got the flower spotted Schaefer, which is a ripper, and then we've got the fiddler beetle that's got these, and it gets its name from the pattern on those outer hardened wings that aren't used for flying, and they've got a pattern of like a violin or a fiddle, which amazing green patterns on this dark shell, and quite a sizable beetle. So one of the things we're trying to say is, if you know where to look for things, these insects aren't necessarily small once you get used to seeing them. It's your perception, right? And some of these larger beetles, you can see them. You don't need binoculars necessarily.
Yeah, it's very true. And it's interesting when you look at a flowering tree or flowering shrub, like your kunzia or your baseria. Yep. Like, once you stop and have a really good look and settle down, you start to see that there is so many insects around. You don't notice it at the start. Like, you might notice a few going to the flowers, but then some afternoons in the sun there's just a myriad of them. They're just dripping off the trees.
Yeah, and I guess we're trying to encourage people to be able to go to certain habitats, and we're encouraging people, and from spring, you know, mid-spring all the way to mid-summer, we think that in most Melbourne environments you want an indigenous white flowering shrub flowering. So it starts with Elaria lyrata in the landscapes we're used to in Nillimbik. And then from there you're getting like your Bergen flowering, your kunzia. Then you got your Prostrantha. And then a little bit later on you're getting Cassinia longifolia. and then you're getting sweet berseria. And because they're providing thousands of flowers, like sweet berseria on one particular shrub might have 10,000 flowers with so much nectar and food. And it's almost like these insects are giddy on them and they don't want to leave. So even if you get too close, they don't leave. And you get a really good look at how cool these insects are. And then the other thing is, after a period of time of getting used to doing it, I mean, we've been doing it for years, you see their services. Like, you start thinking about that. What is their role in the system?
It's very pertinent to mention the white flowering trees. In fact, I think that might be one of the themes on this show. But it's also, I feel it's necessary to say that they're also just one element in the system that supports insects. Because you need so many different elements to support as many possible insects as you can. So long grass comes into it, or dead shrubs, or other shrubs, and lilies and daisies, and every sort of element. The more elements you can have, the more likely there's going to be higher diversity in the insects.
Well, for instance, in my surveys of recent, in the last few years, it's all very well to have your sweet berserias that draw in a lot of insect richness. So richness means the amount of species, but blue-banded bees very rarely go there, checkered cuckoo bees. So you want these bang-for-your-buck shrubs.
Yeah.
But then you want also these other plants around there, like your purple loosestrife and your hop gardenia. So blue-banded bees will go to those plants. And the other thing to factor in is life cycle. So if you want that next gen, you've got to think about where insects lay their eggs.
That's
think
true.
Think about poa species. So we'll move on to, we've talked about beetles. We thought we'd just mention flies. I mean, flies get a bad rap, but, you know, they're so amazing. We see
Louis the fly.
We see on these white flowering plants just a diversity of beautiful flies. So they can be mimicking wasps. They can be pollinating. They can be providing a food. So we want to say how amazing flies are.
Big up the flies.
Big up the flies, man. And so going back to one of our objectives about thinking about the role of insects in the system and how they influence animal groups further up the trophic chain, I mean, we can start thinking about birds. So you often might see, say, a whistler, so a golden whistler or a rufous whistler with caterpillars in their beak. Now, these caterpillars are really rich in nutrients. They're easy to digest. And, you know, without a food source, as humans, we know we can't do certain things. So when birds are able to get these insect food sources, in particular the insect birds, it allows them to call. And some of the calls of birds is unbelievable. So we've got golden whistler, we've got rufous whistlers, we've got the trill of some of our cuckoos, like the fantail cuckoo, which is absolutely unbelievable. And then we've got the olive-backed oriole. And last year, both of us picked up that bird not only has its own fantastic call, but it mimics other birds like your Rosella and your Galahs, which is
it's
so
quite
amazing.
Extraordinary, the mimicry that that the birds do. I was so surprised to hear that oriole. I was sort of falling off my seat if I was sitting down.
Well, one of the things I can guarantee with nature is you're always going to be learning something.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to learn and you're going there and taking information and be open to learning. It just, it delivers in that shape and form every time.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's where it comes down to observation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And the other thing insects are great for, it's not only feeding birds, but they also are feeding some of our most majestic, threatened and loved mammals, like the brush-tailed phascagirl. If you had a prize about some of their scat, which I actually did last year, I was seeing all these iridescent wing casings.
Beetle casings.
Hard wing casings we're talking about before. And I looked under a microscope.
Mm.
The colours, the patternings, all these little bumps and intrusions, I don't know why those bumps are there. We're saying in our first episode, we're trying to hammer home the point that, which we will over time, is managing for insects, unbelievable. Think about systems and just on a minute level, check out some of these insects on your white flowering shrubs.
Check it.
Yeah, check. They're unbelievable.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
Oh, that was cool. That went so quickly. It seems like we have to sign off. But there's a song involved with this program, isn't there?
Absolutely. That's one of our objectives, to have a tenuous link.
A tenuous link indeed. What's the link and what's tenuous about it?
Well, the link is, it is the violin. And so the violin shape on the Fiddler Beetle is linked in with the person that plays the violin within the last drink. So you may have heard of Cash Savage in last drinks.
Fantastic.
And I remember being at a festival called Out on the Weekend in Williamstown and looking at the stage, and then there were this person was playing violin and breaking the strings and just going hell for leather. It was one of the most fantastic things I've seen at a festival, so I was loving that. So within the song called Run With The Dogs by Cash Savage and the Last Drinks, there's a violin playing.
Awesome.
Now the dogs are barking, they come to take you home. Cut a path over the hills, and through the hills you run.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favorite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter. Food Not Bombs.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. That song you heard before that announcement was Run With The Dogs by Cash Savage and The Last Drinks. And before that, you heard the first of our new regular segment here on the Monday Breakfast Show called Wing Beats Per Minute, talking about the importance of insects within ecosystems. And we're now going to hear an excerpt from yesterday's Concrete Gang show. In this excerpt, the folks at the Concrete Gang show respond to the allegations against the CFMEU released in Jeffrey Watson SC's report on Wednesday at Queensland's Commission of Inquiry, in particular the allegation that $15 billion worth of taxpayer money has passed through the union for so-called corrupt behaviour.
Obviously, the Watson report was tabled through the Queensland Inquiry. And, you know, $15 billion, and, you know, like some of the stuff in that report, you know, is totally disgusting. But, you know, so I think none of it's been tested. None of it's been, you know, even Irving, I think, is questioning the $15 billion figure.
Yeah.
I don't think any of it's been fact-checked at all.
Yeah, no. That's been publicly stated. That hasn't been fact-checked.
It's one bloke's opinion.
Yeah.
And it was written like an article for the paper, really.
Oh, yeah. Like, I literally, yeah, yeah.
The headline,
Rotten from the Top, was it?
Yeah.
If you look at bias in the dictionary, that's what comes up.
Pretty much calling
it a bias report.
The whole union and everyone in it a part of it, a crime syndicate. Yeah, you know what I mean?
It left himself open for a few law cases, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Companies. And not great. Not great.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And it just seems to point the finger at a handful of people. But, how many companies are involved in all this here, you know what I mean? Multinational companies and all this here, you know?
Where do you get his info from? I haven't spoken to him.
Yeah.
I've never even seen him.
I don't even know. Yeah.
So where's he getting the info from?
Like, you know, you're talking to some of these shoppies on these big bill jobs and all that. Mate, this stuff about the strippers, like...
They're on the wrong job.
Yeah, like, I don't... like the construction the construction industry is the worst place to keep a secret. I never heard any of this stuff.
Absolute dribble.
Yeah,
we missed out on a few beers by the sounds of it.
And it's turning around making out that women are all for that as well. Like, so because a woman goes on the job and then automatically someone offers them money, like they're going to start stripping for everyone.
Mm.
Like what?
It's just bullshit.
Like,
and as a union, you know, we've pushed and advanced, and we have strong women leaders in our union like Lisa, and we've had others like Esther and other women. They would not stand for that.
No, that's right.
I'd be more comfortable with the females in my family or friends, whatever, working in this industry, because I know they'd be more safe than they would be in some of these other. Look at Channel 9, the bullying and stuff was on there.
Yeah,
I'd be more happy with my family working in this industry than I would be in any other industry where they're represented by unions who don't care about them, bosses who don't care about them. And no one follows up on it. You know what I mean? That's the only problem is that we're that good at looking after the members. We're the first target.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You come down, they're talking about the CFMU tax, all this here. All they're talking about is wages and conditions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They just want to cut our wages and conditions so they can give the money back to developers.
And the way they're talking,
that's a fact.
Like we're standing over people with aggressive, like safety, bringing up safety issues and safety campaigns, and basically, if you pressure and campaign someone to do an EBA, because let's be honest, the bosses don't want to pay our rates, they don't want to do that.
Yeah.
People don't want to do it.
What
our members want it. We want it. The industry has money to pay it. We want our fair share. We're not asking for the Queen's ransom or, you know.
And the reality of it is, a lot of these multinational companies and builders and that there, although they don't want to use our subbies because of the price tag, they need the quality of work that our subbies provide. And just the Westgate is the perfect example of that. Mm. You know what I mean? The quality of subbies is what they needed there at the start. And they went for the low ball prices. And then who comes in and fixed it? The CFMU came in and fixed all the tunnel leaks.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
But the fact is too...
Continuing to fix it, actually.
You look at... Again, they go to the lowest tender, right? You look at the blowouts on the Westgate. You look at the blowouts on the Metro Tunnel. Mm. Well, why aren't you pulling the companies in who do those jobs?
Exactly right.
Why aren't you holding... Like, I know in commercial construction, if, say, Lendlease or a multiplex or whatever, they give a price... They've got to hit that target. They've got to hit that target.
Well, look, even at Wembley, it nearly crippled multiplex, but they honoured it and got it built.
Exactly. You know what I mean? And you talk about the Westgate delays. The delays were there was contaminated soil. The government and the builder didn't allow for contaminated soil. And us, the public, had to pick it up because of that. There could have been other ways to manage that, but they didn't design it. They didn't do their due diligence before they started the job.
Not to mention the steel was meant to be Australian-made steel. They got it from China, opened the containers, and it had lead paint all over it.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, who's policing that?
You look at the Wattpac, what they did at Geelong.
Oh, yeah.
The Geelong, you know,
same
football
deal.
Stadium, they used cheap Chinese steel, and the steel didn't come up to scratch.
And so then it all had to get fixed up in Australia.
It's all good and well for the whole industry to blame all the industry problems on us. Hey, we're not perfect, but, you know, we shouldn't get blamed for stuff. It's not our doing, you know what I mean?
Poor mismanagement of jobs, basically what it comes down to. And it's been no good kept secret, whatever. The whole of the civil infrastructure game are struggling to find good management because no one wants to do it.
And there's a lot of work all at once.
Yeah.
A lot of work, which it's hard to get the
And
people.
If you do get someone who's half decent, he doesn't last that long because no one wants to listen to him. No. You know what I mean? When you turn around and tell people the facts, they're just like, well, nah, it's not good enough. We're this budget and go, well, can't pull a rabbit out of a hat. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You look at all these big build jobs, especially the big infrastructure ones. Look at the amount of management that start the job and get turned over by their own companies because they're incompetent of what's been happening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And then they blame oh, well, you know, the AWU and all this. The AWU don't represent the members. The members come to the CFMU. They join the CFMU because they want representation.
Hmm.
They want someone on the knee on the head, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, and we're, it's easy to play the card and, you know, we're the biggest issue in the whole thing. Well, maybe when the government needs to have a look at all the other stuff in the joint, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, do an inquiry. Like, they talk about the stripper stuff and like we just said, what about the reports that come out about the girls having to pay money to work on these big build jobs?
Yep.
That wasn't the union. That was the bosses.
That was the bosses.
Yep. Yep. It's the tunnel superintendent.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the main men getting people in there and just abusing his position and basically standing over them for money and objectifying them and all that there. And what's come out about that? I didn't see any of that in his report.
We don't direct employ anyone on the ground. We employ about 20 organisers, 30 organisers at the minute. We're not employing anyone. We're not paying anyone's wages on these jobs.
Yeah. And whenever there is accidents on the job or there is incidents on the job, we turn up. That's if we're guilty of anything, it's turning up for the members when they ring us.
How dare you?
And these jobs run off a competitive tender process. Yeah. There's a whole tender process. Well, that's got nothing to do with us. No. We'd love to say we pick every subby on every job. Well, please.
What about the missing ute?
Yeah. Oh, mate. Look at the Metro Tunnel. They lost the ute for 6 months, and they're like, where's this ute gone? They find it. They send it, pay a labourer to go around and try and find it, and supervisors go to the toolboxes and try and find this ute. So they paid a bloke considerable money to walk around trying to find utes. And what happened was the ute got impounded. And was impounded by the own government. It was a government ute, and it got impounded.
For 6 months, no one knew what it was.
Yeah, so that's the calibre of people running these jobs.
Yeah.
So,
and that's just the tip of the iceberg as well.
That'd be our fault.
Have you listened to them in the last thing? Apparently construction workers have the right to down their toes at 35 degrees.
How dare they?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I'd like to see them sit in their studios,
put
the temperature up to 35 degrees and sit there for 12 hours.
And do manual labour.
Yeah. And have one smoke break and have one lunch break and see how you go.
And I see now the
day in, day out.
The ACTU, after the CFMU and the construction unions, all the construction unions are blued for years to win 35. And the medical advice says you should stop.
Yeah.
36, sorry. Now the ACTU are coming out, we're starting a campaign on that. Like,
It's already been done.
It's already been done. And all you've done is allowed people to attack it, mate. You know what I mean? Like, why wouldn't you bring it across the nation? You know what I mean? But no, it's always, all of these.
And it's as if it's a luxury. Yeah. But here, what happens when it's 34 degrees and direct sunlight and you're still working?
You're working, yeah.
No one's out there saying, But we're getting overpaid for all this sort of stuff, you know what I mean?
And in the what was in bee picks, they keep, in the Queensland inquiry, they keep going on about bee picks, better off overall. That's minimum standards of what should be on the job about the heat. The heat in Queensland, I think it's 36 and 87% humidity. So, you know, it's not just... We go home. And it's not like we control the temperature. Yeah. It's actually in the agreements. It's written at weather stations and all that.
And I love how they sort of make it like it's all wasted money because they're using CFMU EBA contractors and all that who pay their fair share of tax.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. So you can say, they're getting X amount or whatever, but a lot of that just goes to the tax man. You know, how many of these multinationals are paying their tax?
Amazon, Google.
Amazon, all these people, they're not paying any. At least
Apple.
Our people are paying their tax and all that there, you know what I mean? And we're treated as if we're the enemy.
100%.
Because we're in there, and mind you, they say, it's an easy gig. I don't know any easy gigs in construction. I really don't. Rocking up, whether you're on your feet for 12 hours a day or sometimes more, depending on what sort of shift you're doing, you know what I mean? Yeah. Imagine you're these asbestos, people who remove asbestos. You know what I mean? You're in the suits and the heat, doing it until you get heated off. If you get heated off and you only get, you know what I mean? They have their breaks and all that because they've got to decontaminate and then they got to re-suit up again and go back in.
But even like, look at the cleaners. I've had safety issues where the cleaners have been using toxic fumes and get done with and crook and all this lung stuff. And, mate, some of them, the cleaners, how hard they work. Like,
Last on bullets. The job.
Yeah, you're in glass and the screen. Like, there's no air cons on that.
It's always where the mad push is to at the job. Oh, working 100%. Mega hours to get it handed over.
At the end of the day, you're always going to get people from that sort of right-wing conservative point of view, not liking that the blue-collar workers actually getting a decent wage. You know what I mean? And they bring up the nurses and the fireys and all that. They only get paid this? Well, let's bring them up.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's bring them up. Why do we have to round down? Let's bring them all up. Let's float all boats.
But they don't talk about the profits these building companies are making. They don't say, say CYP being $1 billion profit or, you know, these John Hollands, all these major builders that are doing these jobs, how much profit they're making. They don't talk about that, but they talk about the poor construction worker, the poor traffic controller. They made their little bit. They shouldn't be able to do that. So they'd rather a multinational from overseas get the money than a person who actually spends the money in Australia, works in Australia, pays their tax, hard-working, honest people. And they'd rather see them get done over. It's a bloody joke.
And imagine if you actually went through the books and all that there. I mean, like you said, construction's the worst place to keep a secret. You have all these stories on infrastructure projects where bosses who are lining up their own companies in there with their own machines and all that.
Excavators
there, you know what I mean?
Parked up for months,
you know what I mean?
Not
turning a bit of dirt. What about that? That is absolute government waste there. That is absolute waste. But where you got someone out there knocking his pan in, tying Rio, pouring concrete, whatever it may be, he's the enemy. You know what I mean? And that Jared Bly up in Queensland, he's the same. Banging on about the Olympics, I'll rob, borrow, steal any worker small of it after you just demonised all the workers up there. So
good luck with your Olympics up there, man.
And when they do eventually have to call in the CFMU trades to come in and fix it,
100%.
You'll know who to blame.
Always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out to sham contracting arrangements.
On 8:55 a.m. and on the web, 3cr.org.au.
You're tuned in to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. You just heard an excerpt from yesterday's iteration of the Concrete Gang Show, focusing on Jeffrey Watson SC's report tabled at the Queensland Commission of Inquiry last Wednesday. To listen to the rest of yesterday's show and more from the Concrete Gang, go to 3cr.org.au/concrete-gang or listen live on Sundays from 9:30 to 10 a.m. We are now, before we head into our next segment, I just thought I'd quickly mention that the next segment will, or may mention suicide and transphobia. So if you feel that the content may affect you, feel free to tune back in around 15 minutes or so. I'll just give listeners a moment to tune back out. Anyway, we're now joined by Dr. Corinna Saxby to tell us about research released last week revealing that adding gender-affirming surgery and care into the Medicare scheme would save millions in taxpayer dollars. Dr. Saxby is a senior research fellow at the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research at the University of Melbourne. On the 7th of February, the Good Law Project over in the UK released information gathered from a Freedom of Information request, which detailed that between 2019 and 2025, 46 trans children under the age of 18, died by suicide, 22 of which took their own lives between 2021 and 2022, coinciding with the December 2020 Bell v. Tavistock ruling, which led to restrictions on trans children under 16 accessing gender-affirming care. Good morning, Corinna.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show. So, yeah, Corinna, maybe you'd like to start by telling us about the research.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got two studies that came out last week, which are looking at how trans and gender diverse people's use of mental health care changed after they initiated either hormone therapy, so gender-affirming hormone therapy, or how it changed after they had gender-affirming surgery, so top surgery or bottom surgery. And really for both of those studies, we find that after people initiate these types of gender-affirming medical care, there's a significant reduction in use of mental health treatment, so fewer visits to a psychologist, fewer antidepressant scripts, and importantly that these sort of reductions, they're persisting for even up to 5 years after people initiate this sort of gender-affirming medical care. So really profound reductions in mental health care use, and that, of course, translates into really big reductions in costs and sort of subsidies that the government provides to this mental health treatment.
Mm. And of course, as we mentioned in the intro of the interview, potentially could save lives of trans and gender diverse people, right?
Yeah, so we have had some really good empirical evidence showing that access to gender-affirming medical care can reduce gender dysphoria, it can reduce psychological distress and feelings of suicidal ideation, and there's some good empirical evidence of that sort of around the world now. So really this research is then bolstering that to show that in the long term, it does appear that access to this type of care really does improve mental health among trans and gender diverse people.
So how much does your average set of gender-affirming care or surgery cost?
Yeah, so it's very variable, and it does depend on what sort of individual's goals are and so on. Like, so some people might not be on, say, estrogen or testosterone-based hormone therapy, you know, for their entire lives. Some people might reach the sort of goals that they're looking for and then reduce the amount they're on, but it does vary. So some people maybe are spending, say, you know, between $200 to $400 a year on hormone therapy. But then when we're thinking about things like gender-affirming surgeries, which are really not covered under Medicare, this is more like thousands of dollars, so in the 20,000s to more. Out-of-pocket costs, so it can be really, really expensive.
And I know from a fact that, you know, many queer people in my life, queer people that I know of, their only solution for this is to either, you know, find some, like, run into some large amount of money or simply just fundraise between the community, right? So,
yeah. Absolutely. And one thing that we're also hearing anecdotally is that people are actually dipping into their superannuation scheme to try and fund some of this care. So that's like very worrying because, of course, that is so important for retirement and just sort of having that wealth generation over time. So it is a real worry that people are kind of having to resort to these sorts of these practices to try and fund access to this care.
Do you think that speaks to how needed the gender-affirming surgery and care is to some people?
Yeah, I think that people, the amount of gender dysphoria that can be reduced by people being able to access this type of care is really worth it for people. So they're willing to pay a lot of money to try and get access to this care and better align their physical appearance with their gender identity. So it just really does speak to the fact that people are really willing to try and better align their gender identity with how they feel, and they're willing to pay a lot to do this.
So maybe you can talk to us, Dr. Saxby, about how you got to the result of saying adding gender-affirming surgery and care into Medicare scheme would save millions. Like, what does that maths look like?
Yeah, so I suppose it's a bit different for each of the types, so for hormone therapy versus surgeries. But in particular, if we just focus on surgeries for now, they're really not covered under Medicare. So as I mentioned, people are paying, you know, over $20,000 out of pocket to get access to this care. The idea would be if they could fund this under Medicare, the government would be then sending a signal that this is cost-effective care and we should be, you know, subsidising this to an extent for Australians. Then if we consider the cost of these surgeries relative to the cost that we're observing in terms of the reduction in mental health treatment, it's really a no-brainer for the government, because we see that, you know, within a couple of years, the money that they've spent on these sort of one-off top or bottom surgery costs, they're already eclipsed by the reduction in mental health treatment. And if we do that maths, if we say, look at the average rebates for top or bottom surgery between $1,000 to $2,000, but then look at these huge reductions in mental health treatment that are persisting for over 5 years and are likely to persist after that, you know, we've got this $42 million in savings within 5 years. And I should note as well, this is actually really an underestimate, because we're looking at a very conservative number of people who we think would access this care. And we also think that this reduction in mental health treatment savings, that's going to persist, you know, throughout the life course. So I'm doing this 5-year, very conservative estimate, but it's likely that the savings will be a lot larger.
And I'm wondering if your research looked at, did the research look at only trans and gender diverse people accessing these types of surgery and care? Because, yeah, of course, like, gender-affirming care and surgery is not just something for trans and gender-diverse people, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so, and I think that's one of the big misconceptions that the media sort of shuffled around, is that actually the largest share of people who access hormone therapy are cisgender Australians. So people, for example, accessing this type of hormone therapy for precocious puberty, for example. But specifically for our study, we were really limited to only look at people who did access care, and that's just simply because the data doesn't exist at the moment. Hopefully early next year we'll have access to the census data. So as you know, in August this year we're going to have questions on both sexual orientation and gender identity in the census. So the hope is that we'll actually have a better picture of how many people are trans and gender diverse, how many people are accessing medical care of that population, and this will really help with sort of the research in this space moving forward.
And it might give you a clearer idea of just how much money it could save, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly if we combine that with other research around how many people we know would want to have this type of care.
Very interesting. Well, I hope that it does help your research, and yeah, hopefully that gender affirming surgery and care are added into Medicare. What is the likelihood, do you think, of that happening?
It's very difficult to say. We know that some of these gender affirming surgeries are happening already in the public system, but the waiting times are over, you know, a year and a half. So, you know, some surgeons are doing this already. We've now got the data showing the Medicare MSAC, who's the sort of the committee that decides whether they're going to fund this, we've got the data showing that it's very cost effective to do this. So hopefully we're going to get a decision about that, you know, within the next couple of months. It's very hard to say how likely that is, particularly with some of the, I guess, recent politicisation of gender-affirming medical care, and also the fact that we're seeing, you know, some states banning access to gender-affirming hormone therapy. So even if they do, you know, say, yes, we're going to fund it on Medicare, there's then the worry that some states might say, oh, well, we're not going to allow access. So it's very difficult to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show, and yeah, also for connecting the dots into how important gender-affirming surgery and care is for all people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me.
No problems. That was Dr. Corinna Saxby talking to us about research they released last week, revealing that adding gender-affirming surgery and care into the Medicare scheme would save, with a conservative guess, $42 million in taxpayer money. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. Stay tuned.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan.
Welcome to Rainbows Don't Fade with Age on Radio 3CR.
Welcome to Trans Creator Radio.
Where history's queer futures is an audio journey into the
Trans
stories.
Day of Audibility, a day for us to be heard and not seen.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Your fake leather jacket, I'll never leave it on the floor. It makes me feel like Buffy. Stronger than I was before. And I will send the boys running. I will send the boys running. I will send the boys running. I will send the boys. Running. And my new black choker, just like the one you always wore. It makes me feel pretty. And I wish my makeup looked like yours. And I will send the boys running.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That song was New Black Choker by The Crop Tops, a trans folk punk group based in Nam and made for rat bags. I'll put the link to that song and the study that we mentioned in our conversation with Dr. Corinna Saxby in the notes of the podcast that we published for the show. It is 8:27, just about, a.m., which means we've only got a few minutes left of the Monday Breakfast Show for this week. Yeah, so I'll just do a quick rundown of everything that we featured on the show before Women on the Line begins. So we started the show with the second half of an interview that we played initially last week from the Tuesday Home Time show, in which Jan Bartlett spoke with Kathy Kelly about the climate of fear and intimidation over in the US, in particular with the recent actions of ICE. And then we heard the first of our new regular segment here on the Monday Breakfast Show called Wing Beats Per Minute, focusing on the importance of insects within ecosystems. And following that, we heard a conversation from yesterday's Concrete Gang show responding to the allegations released in Jeffrey Watson SC's report on Wednesday, tabled at the Queensland Commission of Inquiry. And yeah, the show ended talking about adding gender-affirming surgery and care into the Medicare scheme would save millions in taxpayer dollars. That's in new research released by Dr. Corinna Saxby and their colleagues, which brings us to the end of the show. So with that, I'll see you next week and stay tuned for Women on the Line.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.